We're still in our series on Ezekiel. I hope we haven't got too fed up with it just yet, but there's more and more in it to discover. And we've reached Ezekiel chapters 40 to 43 for today. I'm not going to read them all today, but please have a read of them if you haven't. It's fascinating. If you're interested in buildings and architecture and mathematics and everything, then you'll enjoy those chapters. But I just want to read some verses from Ezekiel 43 today, the end of this particular passage, and verses 1 to 12, and then just share some thoughts on that today. So Ezekiel chapter 43, starting at verse 1. So Ezekiel has this great vision again. He sees this man describing for him the temple in great detail. And then we pick it up here, Ezekiel, verse 1. Then the man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of the God of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters, and the land was radiant with his glory. The vision I saw was like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions I had seen by the river Kebar, and I fell face down. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, I heard someone speaking to me from inside the temple. He said, "Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I live among the Israelites forever. The people of Israel will never again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings at their death. When they place their thresholds next to my threshold and their doorposts beside my doorposts, with only a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by their detestable practices. So I destroyed them in my anger. Now let them put away from me their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings, and I will live among them forever. Son of man, describe the temple to the people of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their sins. Let them consider its perfection. And if they are ashamed of all they have done, make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangement, its exits and entrances, its whole design and all its regulations and laws. Write these down before them so that they may be faithful to its design and follow all its regulations. This is the law of the temple. All the surrounding area on top of the mountain will be most holy. Such is the law of the temple." Seems like Ezekiel's had a lot to watch, but never a repeat. Unlike us, I suppose, these days. I was thinking about the glory days. Do you remember the glory days? Stanley Matthews running down the wing at Stoke City. Remember the glory days? I don't remember them, but I'm guessing some of you might remember them. Or maybe ABBA, you know, the first time round. The glory days of ABBA. I don't know if you've heard their recent offerings, their re-releases. It doesn't quite sound like the glory days to me anymore. But never mind, I'm sure they meant well. Or maybe the glory days for churches. Maybe you remember the glory days of a particular church that maybe you were part of, and when perhaps, you know, you saw God do amazing things. Or what about your glory days? When were you at your best, I wonder? When did that happen? Perhaps we should have a little moment to talk about that. Or maybe you've never felt at your best. Maybe the glory days are still to come. I wonder if we could believe the glory days are still to come for Stoke City, for ABBA, for the churches, and maybe for me and for you as well. I don't know. But I guess when you're in exile, I guess that's some of the feeling. When you look back to the glory days of what used to be. You know, when the temple was full, when it was buzzing with people, when the singing was as loud as it's ever been. But you must look back when you're in exile to those glory days, when you felt that God was at his best as well as you were. But I guess as you've been away from home longer and longer, and by now the people of Israel have been away from home a long time, I guess looking back becomes even more important for you. When things haven't gone right for a long time, looking back becomes even more enticing. Even though those days back then weren't always great, They weren't perhaps as great as they thought, or they thought they remembered they were, because very much things went wrong back then for the people of Israel. And that was why they went into exile, after all, because God had had enough of them way back then. But throughout Ezekiel, God has been trying to get the people of Israel to look forward, not backwards. He's been trying to cast a vision for them to say, do you know what, there's something even better ahead. And there is hope in the future if you will just continue to trust me and the visions and the things that Ezekiel has said to you all this time. And once again in chapters 40 to 43, he does invite them to look forward with hope once again. So in terms of time scale, we're about 20 years now from the initial vision that Ezekiel had in Ezekiel chapter 1 on the banks of the river Kebar. He was there with the shattered hopes and dreams of the people of God, wondering what was going to happen. And he had that initial vision when he saw that strange contraption move away from the temple and actually follow them to Babylon in exile as well, where God's glory moved away from the temple and it started moving east. You can see that in chapter 11. And now here we are, 14 years after the news that Jerusalem had been destroyed, 14 years after his own wife had tragically died. You remember how God sort of used those two moments as a sort of an example of what how they should respond to it. And in chapter 40, verse 1, it says, on that very day, the hand of the Lord was on me, and he took me there. And so begins this next phase of this vision as God took Ezekiel back to that place in Jerusalem, to the temple that he had once known but he knew now was destroyed. In Ezekiel 40, in the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th month, in the 14th year after the fall of the city, on that very day, the hand of the Lord was on me, and he took me there. In visions of God, he took me to the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain on whose south side were some buildings that looked like a city. Remember, the city's been destroyed, so this is definitely a fresh vision for him. And I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. He was standing in the gateway with a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. And the man said to me, son of man, look carefully and listen closely and pay attention to everything I'm going to show you, for that is why you have been brought here. Tell the people of Israel everything you see. And so begins this outline of what Ezekiel presumes is a new temple in Jerusalem. And you'll see details and measurements and walls and thicknesses and how everything is located again in that space. In chapters 40 and 41 and 42, you'll see it all laid out line by line. But it was just a building. It was just a framework. It was just a shell. There was no life inside it at that particular point. And then Ezekiel 43, verse 2, the glory of the God of Israel came from the east. So it's all very well having this magnificent building laid out, but until the glory of the Lord comes back into that temple space, just as it had gone, now God's glory returns into that place again. You know, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for glory is kavod, and it means the weight of God's presence, a heavy weight of God pressing down upon people and upon that space as well. It's something you can feel. It's something that you can almost touch and experience. And you know it's there even if there aren't enough words to describe what it really feels like or the experience you have. But it is the glory of God pressing weighty on the people, on each of us. But of course, the glory of God we know from Ezekiel isn't confined to a space because it's left it once and now it's coming back. The glory of God is where God is. And that's why I think this vision isn't about the temple, really. This vision is about the people of God. It's about God's presence with his people, God's glory, his weight of his presence pressing in on the people that he calls to follow him. And this vision doesn't define who God is or where God can be confined, but I think what it does is it redefines who God's people are in this moment. When he wants them to recover that sense of mission and purpose that he's called them to, wherever they are, whether back in Jerusalem and the temple or in exile in Babylon, God's glory is still where his people are. If you trace the sort of presence of God through the Old Testament, you'll know that back in Genesis, it says very clearly that God walked with Adam and Eve in the garden. In Exodus, he moves with his people. As they're on their journey, he's moving with them. Do you remember the tent of meeting? That place where God's presence was. And when the tent of meeting moved, then they moved with it. When the tent of meeting was in the middle of the community, they looked at it, they gazed at it, they saw the glory of God descend upon that temporary place. And God dwelt in that place. He tabernacled with his people. His glory was right there in the midst of them. And then several hundred years later, of course, the tent of meeting was replaced by the permanent structure of the temple as King Solomon built that temple to honor God, to be a place for his glory. And through the temple, God manifested his love and his care for Israel, but also for people of every other culture who would come to Jerusalem. They were welcome into that place. But of course, what we know of the story is there was rebellion, there was destruction, there was exile, and there was isolation. And although the temple eventually was rebuilt after Ezekiel's visions, the walls couldn't hide the corruption and couldn't hide the problems that the people of Israel had. And of course, in the New Testament, in walks Jesus to walk again with his people, to dwell among his people. Just as that tent of meeting had been there, just as God had walked in the garden, Jesus came to walk with his people. He came to dwell with his people, to tabernacle with them, as John reminds us. And of course, he goes into the temple space and he confronts the leaders and he turns the tables over, doesn't he? Just to say, you know what? This has got to be a house of prayer, this place, but you've made it a den of thieves. See, God's glory was never about a building. God's glory couldn't be contained inside four walls, or however many walls the Ezekiel vision describes. It was always about people. God's glory was about being with his people where they were. And of course, through Jesus' death and his victory on the cross, he made a way for God to not only dwell with his people, but for God to dwell in his people. That his glory became a tangible experience in the lives of his people. And so it's no wonder that the New Testament writers, when they write about the temple, they talk about the people of God. They don't talk about a building. Paul says, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you? The place where God's glory dwells, resides in you." Because the people of God are marked by God's presence, whether in exile or as a returning people, or the people sat here, us, today, this morning, living faithful to the design of God's temple, to be a place of perfection, to be a place of order, to be a place of purpose, a place designed for him to be there in our midst. A people who, in Paul's words in 2 Corinthians, a people who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory and are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. See, this, I think, is the great reassurance from this vision and also the great challenge as well, that God wants our lives to be that temple, that place of order and perfection and purpose, a place that isn't tainted by what goes wrong, but is filled with his glory. Not a place of compromise as the physical temple had become. Not a place as a cemetery to the past, which the physical temple had become, a place for dead kings, Ezekiel says in the vision. But we become a people who celebrate the risen and exalted King who reigns in the lives of his people. In Ezekiel 11, God's glory had to leave the temple. There was no room for him because it had become tainted and compromised. But now God's glory is returning as we make room for his presence and we're available to him as well. See, Ezekiel's vision, I don't think, is given so that the people would build the temple. I think it's so that the people of God would become the temple, the place where God dwells. Redefined people. People God longs to walk with and dwell with and lead and fill with his Spirit. If you take a moment to read through Ezekiel, the word glory is there 19 times. This kavod, this weight of God, it echoes throughout the vision, the glory of God. This is what God longs for, to be seen in and through his people. And without him, we cannot become all that he longs for us to be. In the very last chapters of the Bible, John records in Revelation 21 and 22 his vision of heaven after Jesus returns. And he sees this extraordinary depiction of the new city of God. But if you read the vision, something is missing in that vision. Something is conspicuous by its absence in the vision in Revelation. There's no temple in the city. There's nothing, it's not there. And why would there be? Because we don't need it there, because Jesus is right there. Jesus, the glory of God, is with his people. And what we lost in the beginning is now restored. God himself is once again dwelling with his people. His glory is back where it started, with the people of God for his purpose. You know, as Jesus died on the cross, Matthew records these words, Matthew 27, verse 50. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. And at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. God's glory flooded in once again. Access restored, relationship renewed. God's glory has returned to be where he always intended it to be, where his people are. And this morning, as we pause for moments of communion, as we share in these moments of remembrance, this is our reminder of what has happened. This is a reminder of what God has done to bring his glory into the midst of his people again. That through his initiative, because of Jesus, he enables us to be the people of God, to gather around the table, to be reminded of what we have in common, to be reminded of the hope that we have because of the cross and because of the empty tomb and resurrection. The price has been paid. In the words of that great hymn, we've been ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven. The glory of God is with his people once again. And so this morning, that's what I want us to experience as we eat and drink together. To remember with thankful hearts Jesus, God's gift to us, the hope that we can have in him. To remember the story, to remember that this is our offer of forgiveness through the cross, to be clean so that he can dwell in us. And to renew our relationship with him as we say, God, show me your glory.